our next keynote speaker, Professor Peter Tiersma, whose engaging scholarship, I would say, I'm sure you are already familiar with. Peter Tiersma is Professor of Law at Loyola Law School Faculty and Honorary William Matthew Byer Chair. Prior to attending law school, Peter Tiersma was named a Fulbright Fellow to the Netherlands and taught linguistics at both the University of California in San Diego and Miami University of Ohio. Peter was in law school, but while he was in law school, he was an associate editor of the California Law Review and also served as a law clerk to Justice Stanley Moss of the California Supreme Court. But in addition to that, he has held positions in some law firms throughout the United States. Now, these notes, I think, illustrate very clearly that Tiersma actually merges a background in linguistics and law, therefore impressively raising his research appeal to law professionals and linguists as well. But apart from his early legal articles, where Tiersma actually makes extensive use of speech act theory around the language of defamation and the question of what constitutes perjury, Tiersma brings us face to face with our forebears in his first major work, Legal Language, published in 1999, where he actually addresses the history of our chosen legal terminology since David Mellencamp's landmark, The Language of Law, published in 1963. Tiersma's Legal Language book actually bridges the gap between the legal professional and the professional linguistic historian on account of two disciplines proceeding on separate tracks for too long. However, Tiersma's investigation continues more recently in 2006 with his suggestion that legal language is itself a myth. A myth because it is really just ordinary language with a great deal of technical terminology. And I cannot disregard that as it peers into the future, Tiersma becomes an advocate for plain English reforms on our edge of English. And so I'm delighted to introduce Professor Peter Tiersma, who's now presenting his lecture on law and the technology of communication. Over to you, Peter.
Well, thank you, Jerome, for that very nice introduction. If you want more information, incidentally, I have several websites. I've given you the URL for two of them over here. One is languageandlaw.org, which is sort of my professional website that also has a lot of information about language and law generally. And then a few years ago, Larry Solon and Dieter Stein and I sort of got together and organized something that some of you have heard about called the International Language and Law Association. And I set up a website for that called ILLA.org, and anyone can join at no cost. You just have to get online and send me some information, and we'll keep you in touch with... You will get an email like three or four times a year, not very often, I don't send many out, telling you about upcoming conferences and some recent books that have been published and so forth. And you can also go to the website for some more information. Today I'm going to be talking about how various technologies of communication have affected the legal system. And, of course, mostly today when we think of technologies of legal systems, we think of the Internet, computers, and the Internet. The Internet basically being a way to connect one computer to another. That's essentially all, well, that's, of course, quite an accomplishment. But that's essentially all that the Internet does. However, there are other technologies of communication that throughout the millennia have been extremely important for the law. And those include, first of all, perhaps the most revolutionary change to human communication came with writing. right? So we'll talk a bit about the origins of writing and its importance for the law, and then talk a little bit about printing, which was the next major technology of communication, and how that has affected our legal system. And then we'll finish with, I suppose, what's going to be mostly speculation, because, of course, we're right at the beginning of the computer and internet revolution. So I'll try to make some educated guesses as to how that might affect our legal system. Now, a couple of things I will not be talking about, or I'm going to limit myself, I think, today to statutes, what we normally call public law or the law, rather than talking about contracts, wills, deeds, and other types of legal documents. That is also very interesting. And if you happen to be interested in the role of writing, printing, computers, and so forth on contracts and wills and judicial opinions, then you may want to buy a copy of my book coming out called Parchment Paper Pixels, Law and the Technologies of Communication. And I think it's now available at Amazon and probably other places as well. So today I'm just going to limit myself. I do talk about statutes in this book as well, and that's mostly what I will talk a bit about today. Now, one other thing I want to mention is that there have been a lot of technologies of communication which have had a tremendous impact on our society and culture, but have had virtually no impact on the law as a system. Telephone, television, radio, telegraph, right? All of those have been extremely important in our culture. Lawyers use them all the time. Judges, of course, use them all the time. They're always on their telephones, right? They all have BlackBerries these days. But the BlackBerry, as important as it might be, or to the legal practice of law, has had virtually no impact whatsoever. Same thing with television. Huge impact on society, has had virtually no impact on the law. And we can talk a little bit more about this later if you're interested, but I think the main reason is law is very much a textual enterprise. And so printing and the internet communicate text, whereas telephones and so forth communicate visual images and sound. And the law has never made very much use of visual images and sound in order to store and to communicate legal information. It's relied very heavily on text. All right, so let's go back now, and I'm sort of interested in history. I hope you are too. To ancient Mesopotamia. Mesopotamia, the area, of course, Babylon and so forth, and this is important because this is where writing probably first arose, with some emphasis on probably. Apparently there are, I'm not a scholar in this area, but there are some people who argue that perhaps Egyptian hieroglyphs developed very nearly the same time, or slightly, maybe even slightly before. And there's still some discussion about when the Chinese might have developed their writing system. So we're not 100% sure about this, but most likely the earliest writing system is in the area between the Tigris and the Euphrates River. And of course, that's no accident, because all of that water led to the rise of agriculture, and that allowed the rise of cities and empires and so forth, and all of a sudden they had surplus production, and they needed a way to keep track of all of their production and to keep business records and so forth, and to keep track of the size of their harvests. And that is what writing was originally used for fairly mundane purposes, record keeping especially. But it didn't take too terribly long for people to begin to think, well, maybe writing might also be useful for legal transactions. And so, lo and behold, the earliest known laws that have been discovered are those of Ur-Nammu. This is a copy of them in cuneiform, which is, of course, the writing system that they used, a clay tablet, which contains at least some of the laws of Ur-Nammu, which, well, it's right up there on the screen, were written around 2100 B.C. Now, the laws of Ur-Nammu covered very similar to some of the other older legal systems that we see. They tended to be mainly a system of compensation, right? If you did something wrong, then the list of cause and effect, casuistic, we often call them, statements of the law. If you do this, that will happen. And so you had to pay money. If you kill someone, you would be killed. and so forth. If you are accused of sorcery, you must undergo ordeal by water. They throw you into the river. If you drown and die, you're guilty. If you live, you're innocent, and things of that sort. So that's a little, the earliest known laws. Now, much better known is a later code of laws by the king Hammurabi. Most of us have heard of the famous Code of Hammurabi. Hammurabi's code here, you see, this is a, what you have up there is in the Louvre in Paris, and you know, like most colonial powers, England, France, they all stole tremendous amounts of antiquities, and now, of course, those countries want them back. So maybe someday Iraq will get this back, but for now, it's in France. And this shows the Code of Hammurabi, and down towards the bottom, you probably can't see it too well, but this is cuneiform writing that contains Hammurabi's code. You notice that there's much more prominence in this. This is a stele. So a stele or a stela being a large stone that was placed in a public place at a crossroads or in a marketplace where people would be able to see it. So this is a stele, and notice that there's much more emphasis to Hammurabi, who is standing on the left and receiving the these laws from the god Shamu and the god of wisdom. And so that, I think, is in itself rather interesting. People were not paying a lot of attention to the exact words of Hammurabi's code. In fact, almost no one could read in those days. Only scribes who spent a long time learning an extremely complicated system were able to read, and that was a very small part of the population. So clearly, placing these things in the marketplace or at an important crossroads did not or was not intended to function as a way to educate people about what the law was. It was, and people debate, scholars debate, what exactly the purpose of Hammurabi's code was, but if you look at it, you would think, well, apparently a large part of the purpose was to exalt, to memorialize the great king Hammurabi, who had a code of laws. In other words, it was sort of a glorification of the king. It was really its primary purpose. Now, the Code of Hammurabi was, in fact, there's another interesting thing to see here as well, and that is Hammurabi could not make law. We see that because he receives the law from the gods, right? He does not have the power to make laws himself. He has to get them from the gods. And that is also a fairly common principle. Only at some point do we feel that people are able to make their own laws. So what we have in Hammurabi's code is not that Hammurabi got a scribe and said, here are my laws. Number one, right? No one can ride a camel faster than 5 miles per hour. Number two, but that sort of thing, right? That's not what Hammurabi did. He, or probably his experts, priests or so, recorded mostly known customs. Everyone pretty much agrees on that. And they may have added some decisions that resulted from recent court cases that they had where a certain principle developed, but it's not the case that they made law. They mostly just reported the law. Hammurabi's code was quoted. We know we have lots of clay tablets because they tend to survive quite well, unlike other types of writing material like papyrus, which the Egyptians use, which tends to fall apart as soon as it's exposed to a little bit of water. Clay tablets tend to become stronger when a city is burnt down to the ground, right, which often happened in those days. It's like putting them into an oven to strengthen ceramics, right? So there are a lot of them, and there are a lot of reports of cases, and they do refer to Hammurabi's code now and then, but they never refer to the exact words of the code. So it's only the general principles of the code that would have mattered. So anyway, Hammurabi not making laws, and they were not primarily, or maybe even not at all, intended to educate people as to what the law was. Now that began to change, or at least temporarily changed, in Greece, in ancient Greece. And what happened in Greece, or what seems to have, I try not to use the word cause too much, because, you know, making these decisions about cause and effect is often very tricky, especially with historical areas. But at least what seems to have made possible this change in ancient Greece is a linguistic change, you could say, and that is the development of an alphabet. So the systems of writing that were used by the ancient Babylonians and also by the Egyptians and also incidentally by the Chinese up to this very day are basically symbols that represent entire words or concepts. They're not phonetic, or at least not entirely phonetic. And so this phonetic principle seems to have been developed by the Phoenicians. You've probably all heard of the Phoenicians. They established Carthage at one point, and so forth. But the Phoenicians, and they were traders throughout the Mediterranean area, and they developed the idea of having symbols for consonants. So they developed a type of proto-alphabet that had symbols for all of the consonants. They didn't do vowels. I don't know why. But they simply emphasized consonants. And those ideas, of course, were borrowed by Hebrew and Arabic, right? Which, even today, are primarily consonantal writing systems. Now, both Hebrew and Arabic have devised ways to show what the vowel quality is. But it's not part of the original. I think, for example, if you read the Torah in Hebrew, I think most versions still do not indicate the vowels. Maybe I'm wrong about that. But originally, they certainly did not. So those were consonantal systems. And that, because the Phoenicians traded all around the Mediterranean, ended up in Greece, especially in the island of Crete, and the Greeks had a wonderful new idea, which led to an important revolution in the technology of communication. They thought, let's add vowels. And so they did. And now, as a result, you have a system, which we're all, of course, very familiar with, when using a certain limited number of symbols, you know, maybe 30, 40, 50, something in that range, you're able to represent every sound in just about every human language. And that's a remarkable achievement. And so at this point, we have a relatively straightforward writing system. And that meant, because learning this limited inventory of 30, 40 letters is so much easier than learning 5,000 or 6,000 different characters, right? That led to a great increase in the literacy rate in ancient Greece. Now, no one knows exactly what it was. Some people estimate that in Athens it might have been 25, 30, 40%. But nonetheless, compared to earlier civilizations where it was, you know, a minuscule part of the population that could read and write, we now have a fairly substantial part of the population that can read and write. Now, the Greeks, of course, then soon began to use this new alphabet. Oh, they're the subjects of the Code of Hammurabi. But we can skip over that. To make one of the earliest known codes of Greece, which dates from the 17th century BC from a city in the island of Crete. And here they have a rather, those of you who are linguists may know about the rather odd writing system they started to use initially. I'm very happy that they decided not to continue with this writing system. But if you look closely at it, you can see that the sentence, the scribe starts, let's say, on the left and starts writing towards the right and then drops down a line and turns all the letters around so that the mirror image going back. All right, so if you look here, this is an E going this way, and then you see here the E goes that way, right, on the next line. So you read this way, and then you get to the end and you start reading back this way, and you get over here. It keeps your eyes from getting so tired, because you've done it all the way back to the beginning. I don't know what the theory is, but at any rate, they started to write their laws. Now, in Crete, it was very much, I think, like the Code of Hammurabi. They did this. There's still a lot of debate about the function of writing on laws in Crete. We don't know for sure. Mostly, they seem to have been governed by custom, and this was simply a matter of writing down customary law. But Athens later took it one step further. So what Athens did, and you see there the ancient marketplace or agora, Athens started out very much like the places in Crete. They thought, well, we have writing, we have laws, let's write some laws. And so they got a couple of people. One of them was called Draco. You may have heard of Draco. He wrote down some of the Athenian laws. He wasn't making laws once again. He simply wrote down the laws that already existed. And most of them prescribed death as a penalty. And that's why we call severe laws, at least in English, draconian, right? Like the laws of Draco. And later, someone else wrote some more of the Greek laws. This is someone named Solon. You may have heard of Solon as well. And his laws were not quite as draconian, and he had a somewhat better reputation. But at any rate, mostly Draco and Solon inscribed. They did this. They would carve it into stone. Maybe they didn't do it themselves, but they would supervise, probably workmen, slaves probably, carving these laws, customary laws, into stone. Now, the important change that took place in Athens around the 4th century, which is sort of the high point of ancient Athenian culture anyway, was that they began to use writing in some very writing of law in some very interesting ways. One is that the assembly, which could adopt laws, but basically an assembly of most of the important people in Athens, at some point adopted a procedure. There are at least some historical records pointing to it. I don't know how often they used it, but they developed a procedure where someone who wanted to propose a law had to write it on a white slate, had to write the law on a white slate and put it in the agora. And then people walking through the marketplace could read the law, and they could go to the assembly and they could suggest changes. No, I don't like this word, let's try that word, right? Let's delete this or that. And all of a sudden you have something that begins to look very much like modern lawmaking, where legislators are actually enacting text. They aren't just sort of making decisions or using customary law. They're actually sitting down and thinking about what should our law be, what should the words be of the law, and they are clearly moving towards, I think, a very important part of what we today recognize as being part of what a democracy is. And there's no, it's not an accident that Athens is often considered to be the birthplace of democracy. Now, what also happened is that if this law was adopted, it was once again inscribed in stone and placed in a public marketplace. The ones from Athens have, I think, all disappeared, so you can't find them anywhere in a museum. But at any rate, they would have them carved into stone. And of course, now these laws carved into stone had been adopted by the assembly. They had approved the language. And all of a sudden, the language begins to take on an authoritativeness that it would not have had when all it did was describe custom. And another important development in ancient Athens was that these laws, which were adopted, which were specifically adopted, came to be called nomos. And nomos, the word nomos, basically came to refer exclusively to written law, as opposed to custom, which still existed. But eventually, written law was considered to be the most important type of law. And magistrates, at one point, were forbidden to enforce any customary law if there was a written law on the subject. So we now begin to see that you can appeal to written law, and that written law provides a certain stability, and it provides also a certain guarantee against arbitrary actions by judges and magistrates. You could say, Your Honor, we have a law on that, right? And the judge must follow the law. And of course, before this, judges pretty much did whatever they wanted. So those are very, I think, very important developments that took place in ancient Athens. We also have some records of trials from Athens, and there's at least one, maybe more, but there's certainly one well-known trial in which a question arose about what the law was exactly. Now, in those days, they didn't have printing, right? The judge didn't have a book of laws, so they began to debate what the law was because they're all working mostly from memory. So they said, well, the law's been inscribed and it's in the marketplace, so they sent someone to the marketplace with a piece of parchment or papyrus or something, and had that person write down the law. They would copy the law from where it was inscribed in stone, went back to the courthouse and read it out. And that was then used to decide the dispute. So it begins to look very much like what we in today call the rule of law, right? The notion that law exists, that people should be able to know in advance what the law is, so that they can conform their behavior to the law. And another important aspect of the rule of law is that everyone, including the magistrates, and including the king, and everyone else, should be bound by those laws, that no one is above the law. And it's not perfectly developed in Athens, but at least we begin to see some very clear indications of where the rule of law first starts to be starts to be carried out. Now, some scholars, looking especially at the situation in Athens, these are people who have looked at the role of writing. There's a whole group of scholars who have studied how writing has influenced society in general, and scientific thinking, and promoted democracy, and promoted just about everything. They've suggested that writing, in a sense, caused democracy. And I think I may be overstating, but they draw a very strong link between the process of writing that developed in ancient Greek and the democracy that developed in ancient Athens. And I think this is an interesting question, and I think the link is, there is a link, but it's a relatively, it's not as tight as a lot of people suggest. It's perfectly possible to have something like the rule of law and to have something like a democracy without having a written legal system. We know, for example, if you've studied anthropology, you've studied groups of hunters and gatherers, right? Which is sort of the original system that all people at some point lived under, and we still have a few places in the world where you still have a few hunters and gatherers. Until recently, the Eskimo up in the northern part of the United States and Greenland and so forth. But they had a system that was relatively democratic. They generally made decisions by means of consensus. So, and they certainly didn't have written law. But maybe the most interesting example of where you could have a democracy is something like a democracy and something like rule of law and a very sophisticated legal system, or relatively sophisticated legal system, is Iceland. Now, this is this area is called an area of Iceland called Þingvellir, and it's where the European and the American plates come together. So it's a very dramatic setting. There are a lot of volcanoes. You've heard of volcanoes in Iceland, anyone? Yes. So they have a lot of volcanic activity, right, where these two large plates come together. And it's also a very dramatic setting. And so once every year, the people, or at least the most important people in Iceland, in the summer, of course, because the winter, the weather is pretty awful. And frankly, in the summer, the weather isn't that great either. But at any rate, they would gather at Þingvellir, this dramatic setting. And they would then, first met in the year 930. Iceland was a relatively literate place. They had people who could write. They had one of the highest rates of literacy in medieval Europe. They wrote all those sagas and Eddas and so forth. So they certainly were able to write from a very early stage. But their law was for several hundred years unwritten. Now, was this law? Did they have law? Or was this merely custom? Some people have suggested that in order to have law, you must have writing. If it's written, it's law. If it's unwritten, it's customary law or simply custom. It's a nice distinction, but I think it's an incorrect. Although, to some extent, it works, it is problematic when you try to carry that entirely through. And the Icelanders are a great example because they came together at the Althing, that's why it's called Þingvellir, at this People's Assembly, to settle disputes. And also, if necessary, to make new laws. So they operated like a legislature, but it was popular democracy. You still see it in some of the cantons of Switzerland and some small towns in the east coast of the United States, where the entire town or the entire canton gathers in order to settle disputes. So that's what they did. But they needed to know what the law was, right? And they didn't have written books of law. So how did they, and there was a lot of law in Iceland for them to remember. So the chief, the person who presided over this assembly was called the lögusjömaður, or the law-speaking man, or maybe simply the law speaker. And the law speaker who presided recited all of Iceland's law on a 3-year cycle, because there was too much to recite at once. So one year he went through the first third, the next year he did the next third, and the next year he did the next third, and then he'd start all over again the next fourth. And he was expected to recite it from memory. Now I think this is a pretty clear example. You have a country that operates more or less as a democracy, that has something like the rule of law. The law is explained to people, they're told what it is so that they can make their decisions when they have to judge these controversies by using their laws, right? It's very much like a democracy. Very much like rule of law system, but no writing. It's entirely an oral process. Okay, now, having said that writing is not essential to the rule of law or to a democracy, it is also true that it is very handy. It helps promote that when you have writing, you can use it as a tool. It's not an essential tool, but you can nonetheless, it's a very handy tool to promote the rule of law and to promote things like democracy. Because when you write down legal principles, you can communicate or spread the information to a relatively large number of people. You can educate people about what the law is. And having educated people is a very important part to a functioning democracy. Democracies don't work very well if people don't understand what the law is and don't read, for example. Countries with high rates of illiteracy very often don't have very well-functioning democracy. So it's a very good tool, and it's very useful. And it's also very useful if judges are required to follow written law. Because there's always been a problem of judges doing what they want to do or carrying out their own class preferences and so forth. In Europe, there's been several hundred years ago, there were huge debates about limiting the power of judges in various ways because they were very aristocratic and felt not to to render very good decisions. Written law, of course, is a very important limitation on what judges can do. If they have to follow written law and cannot impose arbitrary decisions or arbitrary outcomes. Now, the problem is, of course, writing helps promote that, but in a way it doesn't go far enough, because how do you distribute a written text? Right? How do you get it around? Well, the ancient Greeks would chisel it into stone, and they would expect people to come along, and you could then, if the literacy rate was high enough, they could read what was on the stone, and maybe they would remember. Another way you could do it was what they did in ancient and medieval England. Very often when Parliament passed a law, they would attach something called a proclamation writ. And this writ would go to the local sheriffs. And there were sheriffs throughout England, and these sheriffs then had a writ, which is typically in Latin, commanding them, in the name of the king, to read the law in a public place at a time when people will gather. That usually meant at the local market. When all the local people came together in the marketplace, the sheriff would read it. See, here, that's the problem. How do you make the laws, even with writing, widely accessible? And if you don't like the idea of putting them in stone or so forth, then I think you have to wait for another technological revolution. And what is that technological revolution going to be? Well, you can probably guess. It's going to be printing, right? So let's move now and talk a little bit about the rise of statutes in the common law system. And for that, we have to go back to merry old England. Now, England was under the domination of the Romans for quite some time. And Romans had written law, a lot of written law during the Roman Empire. And in fact, the Romans are a very good example of how writing does not necessarily promote democracy, right? Certainly during the Roman Empire. Think about, you know, slavery, the emperors who had these coliseums built where gladiators had to kill each other in front of, you know, bloodthirsty crowds and throwing Christians to the lion and destroying the temple in Jerusalem. You get the idea. Not exactly. They were very influential people, and they had a very sophisticated legal system, but as a, you know, their system in terms of, at least from our perspective today, and I think even from their perspective in those days, it was brutal. It was really an awful, awful institution in many ways. But they built some beautiful bridges, coliseums, and all the rest of that. You know? So, at any rate, but all built by slaves, of course. Now, the Romans were in England for a while, and they probably used writing. They must have used writing. Well, we know they used writing. You can go to the British Museum, and you can see some Roman tablets which have contracts on them and so forth. But when the Romans left around 400 AD, because the center of the empire in Rome was being attacked by the barbarians, remember how the barbarians took over the Roman Empire? Some people may not like the term barbarians, but I think my ancestors were included, so I'm applying that term to my own ancestors. The mostly Germanic tribes, right? At any rate, they had the soldiers left England, and at that point, I think we all know the Celtic-speaking English had been sort of demilitarized. The Romans didn't like the idea of the people that they were subjugating having weapons that they could use, right? So they weren't training them to fight. And so now these Celts were being invaded from Scotland and other places, but primarily from what's now Scotland. And they needed some assistance in defending themselves, and they made a very big strategic mistake. They asked some of the Germanic tribes on the coast of the continent to come help them out a little bit. Angles and Saxons, among others. And these Angles and Saxons thought, this sounds like fun. Why don't we go over and have a good fight in England? And they did. They got rid of the Scots and the Picts, but they didn't leave. They took over. And eventually their language, Anglo-Saxon, of course, is the basis for Old English. Now, the Anglo-Saxons were also illiterate. So now we're talking about 500 or so AD, about 1,000 years after the Greeks had developed a very sophisticated legal system that depended upon writing. 1,000 years later in Europe, that system has disappeared, right? It's gone. And so it's essentially, this is a large part of the reason why we call that period the Dark Ages, because all of that, the aesthetics and the knowledge that was developed during that period largely was lost. And so now the Anglo-Saxon is once again illiterate. The whole process seems to be starting over again. That changed, however, when around the year 600, a pope in Rome, down the road or up the road, at any rate, a pope in Rome sent missionaries to England who were Christianized at that point, gradually. The important point for us is the missionaries and the priests who went could write. So, and they were the people, they were officially sort of the scribal class. And once again we find, and it's odd how fairly soon after this, about 20 or so, no one knows exactly how long, 15, 20 years later, the king, the first king who was Christianized, there were several little kingdoms, thought, hey, I'm a king, we have some customs or laws, let's write down our laws. We now have writing, we can write down our laws. And began to write down the laws that they have. So these are the laws of, one of the laws of Ethelbert of Kent. You notice, once again, we're back to, if so-and-so does this, then let that happen, right? So it seems like we've lost about 1,000 years of history here. But eventually, things did begin to change. After this came the Norman conquest in the year 1066. That had some important some very important consequences for the language of law, because it helps explain, and I don't have time to explain it now, but I do so in my book, Legal Language. It helps explain why lawyers, English lawyers, even today, use so much French vocabulary. All of the basic vocabulary about courts, you know, courts, judge, jury, bailiff, judgment, appeal, just about everything, with very few exceptions, is originally French vocabulary. And that's because the language of the legal profession, because of the Norman conquest, was French for such a long period of time. However, we're talking about statutes. Now, statutes were also, the Normans eventually started to enact statutes. And the way that they did it, this parliament, eventually you had a parliament, and the 12th century parliament started to meet, and they would consider various proposals, and they would make some sort of legal decision. And these legal decisions were called by different names in this period, but eventually they sometimes call them constitutions, for example. They sometimes call them assizes. But eventually they settled on the term statute, which came from Latin statutum. And it's interesting, the word statute, if you know Latin, my Latin isn't that great, so I had to look it up. But at any rate, it comes from the Latin word for to decide or to establish. So a statutum is something that is decided, or something that is established. Now, what's interesting about that is that it is something that is in the minds of Parliament, right? Something that you decide or establish is something that is essentially contained in your mind rather than necessarily being contained upon a piece of paper or parchment. So that's how statutes originally started to be adopted in England. And the writing was done not by the members of Parliament. They didn't have a written copy. They simply were told there's a problem. And they would orally decide what to do about it. And a scribe in Parliament would then write down the decision, or at least a summary of the decision, usually in French. And so write a summary decision in French, and that is essentially, if you look at the books of English statutes from this period, 1400s or so, up to the 1400s at least, they're typically written in French, and they're simply a record that a clerk made after the event had happened. Now, you can see, if that's the case, you're an English judge, and lawyers before you argue, oh, Your Honor, there's a statute on that matter, you should follow the statute. And the statute says this or that. You're a judge, you say, well, how do you know? I don't have a book. Printing hasn't been invented, right? It was very difficult to figure out what the text of statutes was. Very often people simply heard about them. And someone told them more or less what the language of the statute was, more or less what its contents was. But, you know, the point here is, as a result, the method of interpretation was extremely loose. You can't have a very literal or strict type of interpretation if you don't have a good copy of the text that you have to interpret. If someone has simply told you about a law, and you're not even sure whether they told you exactly correctly what the law was, or, if would also happen very often, is people would get a copy. But how did you get a copy? You had to ask around to your friends, the other lawyers. Do you have a copy of this law? Yeah, you do. Can I borrow your book? Okay, you borrow the book. You pay someone to get a piece of parchment and to write down what's in your friend's book. Mistakes can be made very easily that way, right? So you can't rely very much on the text. And so as a result, there was very little reliance on the exact language of statutes. But a couple of things happened that changed that in a very important way. One is that in the 1400s, the legislature, the parliament, began to have copies of the text in front of them before they enacted. So they would write out what the text was to be, and they would read it out to the members of parliament. So that when parliament voted, they now voted to enact specific texts. And of course, not long later, printing came along, and printing, of course, now made it possible to give people, and paper, incidentally, came around the same time. So now you've got an inexpensive way to produce copies of texts, which you can give to the legislators, which they can look at, and all of a sudden, judges are starting to pay a lot more attention to the text of statutes. So printing was very important, because printing allows the distribution, the inexpensive distribution, of large numbers of copies, exact copies, of an authoritative text. So everyone has exactly the same copy in front of them. And as a result, judges began to pay a lot more attention to the words of these printed statutes, because they now had in front of them the exact words that Parliament had voted to enact. And as a result, their interpretation became much stricter. For a while, the printing was done by private organizations, and so as a result, there was still some problem because the private printers weren't always very careful. They just wanted to make money, and so they would print them as fast as they could, and so there was still some concern about the quality of these, even after printing. But at least by around 1700, the government took over the job of printing these statutes that were enacted. And just to show you, this is what a statute book would have looked like before printing. It's actually very nice, but it's copied by hand, right? And there are likely to be at least some mistakes. Whereas when the government took over, all of a sudden they were able to print thousands, tens of thousands of copies of any statute. This is one of Queen Anne that was adopted and that was then distributed to all the government offices, and could be the lawyers could buy copies, judges would get copies. Everyone now had exactly the same text in front of them. And that led, at least in England, to a very strict form of interpretation, the plain meaning rule, which arose around this same time, where judges at some point felt themselves completely bound by the text, and the rule arose that they were not to consider any outside information. Anything that was not part of the text was simply not part of the law, and any debates that the members of Parliament had could not be considered. So the lawyers couldn't argue, well, Your Honor, Parliament actually considered that point. You know, they discussed this, and the judge said, I don't want to hear about it. I'm plugging my ears. I'm just going to look at the text of the statute in order to decide what it means. A very extreme form of acontextual or literal interpretation that arose. Okay, now I was going to talk a little bit about the United States, but I think we should move on. The United States, just to tell you about interpretation, we have always had, I moved there when I was a kid, but anyway, we have always had printed statutes pretty much from the very beginning. And even though that's the case, judges have generally not taken this very strict literal interpretation. And the reason I make that point is that even though everyone, there are thousands of exact copies of a statute out there, even though that might tend to make people inclined to give a lot of respect to that text, it doesn't mean that you have to interpret it in a extremely, extremely literal way. Right? It simply makes it possible. We're back to the question of cause and effect and causation. It makes it possible to be a textualist. Because you cannot be a textualist if you don't have a good copy of the text. Right? It simply doesn't work. But just because you have a very good copy of the text, and everyone around you has a good copy of text, doesn't mean that you necessarily have to give it a very literal interpretation. There's simply a natural inclination to try to do that. Anyway, let's get to computers and the internet, because they have also begun, they're the most recent technological change and change in communication, and they have had a huge impact on the law. They already have had a huge impact on the law, and they certainly will continue, I think, to have a very large impact on the law. Now, the most obvious impact that they've had, for those of you who do legal research, is most of us don't go to books anymore. Right? All of those statutes, if you go to a law library in the United States, and I'm sure it's true here as well, lined with hundreds, maybe thousands of books of statutes and reported decisions. The statutes of California take up, you know, several rows, an entire shelf. And the reported decisions of California take up, you know, a small room. And if you include the decisions of other states, well, you have a very large library with 500,000 books. Well, maybe not quite that many, but you have tens of thousands, probably, of books of laws in the United States. And it is very expensive to make all of those. It's very expensive to buy them. And so, as a result, electronic access to statutes and judicial opinions is a very logical way to go. Now, I'm not saying that books are going to disappear. There are some very nice things about books. If you read a novel, it's nice to have a copy in your hands, right? But if you're a law librarian or a law firm and you're spending all this money, the space is very expensive, you have to pay all this rent for the space, it's extremely expensive, and laws change quite a bit, and so whenever there's a change, you have to have a supplement to the law or figure out how to deal with the changes. So electronic media, the internet, is a wonderful resource for most lawyers. So as I said, in many law libraries these days have very few books, and they tend to rely more and more on these electronic databases. Now, as I said, that has some very interesting possible implications. It's hard to say exactly what these implications will be on how they're interpreted or the nature of statutes and so forth. But, well, you might as well speculate a little bit. I've never been afraid to speculate just a bit, as long as no one is writing my exact words down so that I can be proven wrong later. But at any rate, that's one nice thing about oral culture. It's very flexible, right? It changes very easily. People can strategically forget things, and once you write things down, it becomes much less flexible. So there are pros and cons to these technologies. But let's talk a little bit about some of the possibilities of having law online. Now that just about every jurisdiction has just about all of their laws, certainly in the United States, almost every jurisdiction has all of its laws online, going back, you know, at least 100 years, maybe going back to their founding. Now, most of these, incidentally, are maintained by legal databases like Lexis and Westlaw and others, which I'm sure you have here, which I know you have here in Europe as well. So they aren't necessarily always maintained by the government. But some, in fact, are maintained by the court system. So judicial opinions in some jurisdictions are now online on the websites of the courts or the legislature. The Congress of the United States and the California legislature have versions of their statutes online on their own websites. So that brings, I think, or creates a certain number of interesting possibilities. If right now, if you want to know what the exact definitive version of a statute is, then at least in most American jurisdictions, you have to go to a government archive. Because, and this is true in England, for example, as well, when a law is passed, originally it would be, once it had been agreed to by both houses of Congress or Parliament, they would take a piece of parchment, believe it or not, I think they still do this in England, they would get a piece of parchment and they would have the exact text of the law written on parchment, and it would then receive the consent of the Queen, and it would then go into a special government archive. And if there was ever any question about the exact, you know, if there was a comma, and there was a case in the 1940s where a couple of judges actually went over to the House of Parliament to look at their archives to determine whether there was a comma in a particular strategic place. And they weren't willing to rely on the books that they had, because the printers, of course, had to take, they might have made some mistakes, so they had to actually go back to the Parliament to find it. Now, and in the United States today, of course, we keep these in various government archives. So one possibility is we could, and I call this notion, I think I've got a slide on it, dynamic law or e-law. Why don't we say that the official version of the statute is no longer carried in some sort of archive, but is maintained on the legislative website? So every legislature would have an official website, and as soon as a law was passed, that law, that the exact text of that law, would be made available to the public on the website. That would make that exact text far more accessible. You wouldn't have to worry about the publishers maybe getting something wrong, and it would be totally free to anyone who has a copy of, who has access to the internet. So that, it seems to me, is you know, has some interesting advantages as well. One is, and this is why I call it dynamic law, one of the features of the internet, which everyone thinks is so wonderful, is it's dynamic. It's not static, like a book. You know, a book, once it's printed, doesn't change. Right? If you have to make some changes, then in the past, if you made a mistake, the publisher might give you a list of errata. Do you remember those days? And you then take the list of errata and you'd have to cross out one word and write another word in the margin, that sort of thing. That was the only way to update it. Right? Or maybe you could get a supplement. So if it was important, then the publisher might print a supplement. Lawyers have used supplements for quite a while. So you'd have an official book of laws, and then every few years you would get a supplement, and you'd always have to look at the supplement to make sure that the law hadn't been changed. But if we have dynamic statutes where the official version is on the court website, as soon as the legislature makes a change, it can be instantly changed, just like the weather report is changed every few seconds, or stock market prices can be changed every few seconds on the internet. We could have dynamic statutes which could be changed instantaneously. And if a new problem arose, we wouldn't have to wait, you know, for years to do something about it. The legislature could instantly come up with a solution, come up with a new statute, they could enact it, and the next day it could be on the official website. So that's, I think, in some ways a very interesting concept. Law could be kept up entirely up to date by means of the internet. Now, I suppose some of you might say, well, what about stability? Isn't there something nice about the fact that the law at the same time is relatively stable? You know, it's nice to get stock prices right at the very, you know, within seconds of when the price is posted, if you're doing a lot of day trading or something like that. It's nice to know, have very dynamic weather reports, because we want the most up-to-date weather reports we can have. Is it really such a wonderful thing to have dynamic laws? Because one of the nice things about law and the use of writing and so forth is that people can learn what the law is, and they can then conform their conduct to the law. But if the law could change within a second's notice, so that every day you'd have to look at your website again to see whether the law has been modified in some way or other, all of a sudden that gives a great deal of instability to the legal system. Somehow, there's something nice about the idea that the law, like in ancient Athens, was chiseled into stone, and it couldn't be changed. There was no way to change it. It would always leave behind marks, right? So there's something nice about that. The government cannot just suddenly change the laws on a whim, and that stability, I think, is a very important factor. So dynamic law, I think you will see, of course, it's already happening, that statutes are being placed on government websites. I think many will make the online version official, the online version of the legislature itself. We're no longer going to be putting them on parchment into government archives where they put them in a safe. But I don't think that we're going to see legislatures changing laws instantly and having everything instantly updated. There's something nice, at least in the U.S., normally the laws go into effect at the beginning of the year, just once a year. And so you know at the very beginning of the year there may be some legal changes. You read the newspaper, they have a long list of the laws that have been changed, and that makes it much easier for people to understand what the law is and to remember what the law is. Well, let me tell you then about my next sort of admittedly somewhat wacky proposal, Wikilaw. Now, I'm sure most of you are familiar with the Wikipedia, right? I mean, everyone pretty much knows the Wikipedia, which is an encyclopedia online. It's only available online. And the great thing about Wikipedia is this notion of collective authorship. Everyone can be an author and can contribute to an article on the Wikipedia. And someone might write an article on the Wikipedia on a particular subject, and someone else can then add some details or make some corrections if the person got it wrong. And someone else can come along and decide that person number two got it wrong and change things back. You get the idea. So there's some instability there in the Wikipedia. And there have been questions as to how accurate the information is, because for all we know, the people writing these articles in the Wikipedia are high school students or something like that, or unemployed brick pavers. You know, who knows who's doing this? But it's anyone who's got access to the internet can contribute to the Wikipedia, and it's totally anonymous, of course. So no one knows who you are. There's absolutely no accountability, except that there are some people who work for Wikipedia who try to keep a bit of an eye on things. So Wikipedia, it's a very interesting concept, and basically this software that they use in order to allow collective authorship, I think, is a very interesting concept as well. Now, of course, there are other ways to collectively write. Word, for example, Microsoft Word allows for collective authorship. You could put a document now. Some programs allow you when you're working. Larry Solon and I are editing a book. Some of you have written a couple of articles for it and for Oxford, this handbook on language and law. At any rate, Larry at some point organized a website at Brooklyn Law School, and he says, Peter, let's put the articles on the website. So after you edit it, put it on the website. And then you give me access to it, and then I check it out, and I can make some additional changes, and then I put it back on the website, and once it's back on the website, I can check it out again and make some additional changes. I said, Larry, why should we do that? I mean, I'll just make some edits and I'll email it to you. Isn't that a lot easier? Well, anyway, he was very excited about this concept, and I think I don't want to make fun of him because he's not here, and it wouldn't be very nice, and he's a good friend of mine as well. But the point is, I don't think it works very well for two people, but if you have three, four, five people who are collectively authoring something, that's a very useful system, right? Only one person can check it out at a time, make changes, changes are tracked, and so forth. And so the question arises, the legislature. Now, the legislature is deemed to be the author of laws. American judges always look at, what was the intention of the legislature? What do the legislators have in their heads, right? But, in fact, that is almost always a fiction. At least in the United States, laws are not written by legislators. They're written by drafters, legal drafters, lawyers, who are hired to write statutes. So some legislator might say, we need a statute on this or that. Here's how I want it to work. They write it. In England, they use parliamentary drafters who do the drafting. So the legislature is deemed to be the author, but has in fact not written it, and in some cases hasn't even read it before voting on it. So what if we use this collective authoring to allow the legislature to become real authors of the laws that they make? We can turn this fiction into reality by simply putting this on the legislature's computer. Put this collective authoring system on there, allow someone to draft a statute, these legislators. They could type up a statute, and then they could give access to the other legislators, maybe put it on, you know, on the website for about a month or so, allow all the legislators to read it, to make changes, and if they disagree, because sometimes one will want one thing, the other person will oppose it, then the software could generate an email that would go out to all the legislators, and they could vote. Is this word in, or is this word out? Right? Do we use residence, or do we use domicile? And if most vote for domicile, the word in the statute becomes domicile. So we could get the legislature much more actively involved in the process of writing statutes. And in fact, we might then ask, well, why don't we go a step further? If we really want Wikilaw, then maybe we should consider that the legislature acts on behalf of the people. At least in a democracy, laws are made by the people. So in California, the enacting clause of every act says, it doesn't say the legislature of California enacts, it says the people of the state of California enact as follows. And then the law comes. So at least in California and most American states, the people adopt legislation. So maybe we should abolish the legislature and use the wiki software to let people, the people of California, the people of Italy, the people of every place, make their own laws. And someone who's interested in proposing a law would simply have to type it out and place it on a website, and then someone else could make modifications. And once again, if there's a dispute about the exact language, you could have an email vote, and whoever got the most votes would win, and eventually it would become law. Right? Sounds like a pretty interesting concept. I think this is all pretty exciting. And is it going to happen? I don't know. I have tried to buy the domain name wikilaw.com, and unfortunately, someone already has it. Because what I wanted to do was set up an experimental website to allow people in a fictitious country to make their own laws and to see what happens. Right? You would invite everyone in the world who's interested to simply propose laws, and you'd eventually see what you ended up with by means of this sort of software. It's a sort of a legal utopia. Anyway, if I don't have the web name wikilaw.com or wikilaw.org, it's going to be much more difficult to do that. Well, is this really a good idea? Is it going to happen? Once again, I made a slide on this. Yeah. Just because something's a possible doesn't always mean it's a good idea. I think we all realize that. Another consideration is, if you look more closely at the Wikipedia, it's very useful. It's especially useful for current events. So at one point, there was this sort of model. She was actually a Playboy playmate who died. Some of you may know Anna Nicole Smith. And there were some very interesting things relating to her will. And I was teaching wills at the time. So I was getting telephone calls from journalists asking me, well, what do you think about Anna Nicole Smith's will? And I didn't know she had a will. I sort of knew who she was, but I didn't know a lot about her. So where did I go? I looked online, and the first source that came up, Wikipedia. They had a very long article on Anna Nicole Smith with all kinds of information. So sometimes it can be very useful. But where Wikipedia tends to be the least useful is in any controversial area. So if you get a controversial area, so one example is the Middle East, there's a lot of controversy in the Middle East. So if any of those countries that start with an I, Iraq, Iran, Israel, right, are controversial. So what happens is that people, who are in favor of the war of Iraq or whatever, they write articles, and then people are against the war in Iraq, they change the whole history, and they say, no, that's not right. And this happens so much that the Wikipedia actually has to close down the site and refuse to allow any additional changes because it's so controversial. And that suggests, because laws, of course, are going to be controversial, that maybe some sort of wiki software is not such a good idea, or wiki law. Now, I think there's another reason, and that is that law is very complex, especially in our modern world. Some statutes, at least the ones that are enacted by the legislature, can literally be thousands of pages long. Now, that's extreme, but there are some American laws that are, in fact, thousands of pages. Hundreds of pages is not unusual, so you have very long and very complicated laws. And I'm not sure that in our society it's possible to simplify the process very much. The law is always going to be somewhat complex, at least in an adversarial common law system, because lawyers are always trying to figure out loopholes, and then the Internal Revenue Service has to plug the loophole with another provision, then they find another loophole around the plug, and then you get the idea. It becomes very complicated. And I think probably most people don't have a whole lot of time and expertise in order to deal with all these issues as well. So I suppose even though WikiLaw, I think it might work in some small scale, in smaller groups, for example, maybe in small towns it might actually work, but certainly in a large country or a large state, even though I think it's a very interesting concept, it's probably not going to work just because the scale is too large and it's too complicated and difficult to worry. But to the extent, incidentally, that legislators start to use collective authoring software, and I think this is a realistic possibility, that if legislators start to use some sort of collective authoring software, what impact is that likely to have? I think that in the way that printing at least indirectly promoted or made possible a more literal interpretation, because judges now had an authoritative copy of the text that Parliament had enacted, if a judge now gets a statute and knows that the legislature has been using collective authoring software and that they have all looked at the statute and had a chance to edit the exact words, they're probably going to once again defer even more to the text. So at least one possibility is that if WikiLaw at least starts to be used on a legislative, we keep the legislature, we decide, you know, they're the experts, we'll give them the job of making the laws, but they use wiki software to do it, or collective authoring software, I think one possibility is that it will lead to increasingly literal interpretations. It's hard to say. Last question, and I think my time is up, but the last thing I want to discuss then very briefly is something that many of us have talked about already in this conference. Will these changes, the availability of statutes and other forms of law widely available on the internet, at least in the United States, and also I think in most other countries, and before long I think every country is going to be forced to put all of their laws online so citizens can read them, is that going to promote more understandable laws? Or are they going to simply stay the way they are now? Is it not going to change the language of these statutes, or will it have some sort of effect? Now, the reason to think that it might lead to more ordinary language is if legislators, individual legislators, as opposed to the professional drafters, actually start talking about the exact text and start looking at the exact text of legislation, and they don't understand, like ordinary citizens, they don't understand very well what all of this terminology is, they may start insisting, look, if we're going to have to edit this, it's going to have to be drafted in a little more understandable language so that we understand what we are doing. So that's one factor that is likely to promote somewhat more comprehensible statutory language. Now, there's another factor as well, and that is that as these statutes become widely available, printing, of course, made statutes available, but you had to get the book. You had to go to a law library, or you had to be a lawyer and pay for all of these expensive books, right? So they were widely available, but not particularly cheap. But on the internet, it costs nothing. You have absolutely free access to all the statutes and judicial opinions, and people are starting to look at these statutes, ordinary people, and judicial opinions, and trying to figure out what they mean. We see something very similar in medicine. So as there's more and more medical information online, more and more people are trying to engage in self-diagnosis. That drives doctors crazy, you know, because they say, hey, I read this article online, it said this or that, you know, and so as soon as you get, you know, a little pain somewhere, you get online, you know, pain in, you Google pain in knee or whatever, and up pops a whole bunch of websites, and you go to your doctor with the printouts, and you say, I think it's this, you know, you get the idea, and now we've got people who are trying to engage in self-medication, and are we going to have people trying to engage in self-laws, you know, engaging in their own legal services, trying to avoid paying those very expensive lawyers? I think there's absolutely no doubt that some people are going to start doing that. And so that, I suppose, may lead to a bit of a counter-reaction on the part of lawyers who don't want to see all their business go down the drain, and who are likely then to start arguing that no, we can't simplify the law. And they'll give a whole bunch of reasons, just as when they tried to turn the law from French into English, they had lots of good reasons as to why we shouldn't change the law from French to English. And one of the most interesting ones was by Sir Edward Cook, one of the most important judges in England in the 1600s, who said, if we change the law into English, ordinary people, essentially, I'm not quoting, will be able to read it, and they'll think, they'll have this conceit, he used the word conceit, that they understand the law, and they will not understand the law and fall into destruction. So they'll try to be their own lawyers, and they're just going to screw it up, and everything is just going to get worse and worse. Now, that's the argument you're going to be hearing from the legal profession. If people try to start reading these statutes, it's just going to cause all kinds of problems. Then they're going to come to us, lawyers, we're going to have to try to undo it all, and it would just lead to one unholy mess. So we need to keep them in legalese, because when people read a statute in legalese online, and it goes on for hundreds of pages, what do? Give up. Right? And this is exactly what happens, because in California, ordinary citizens can enact laws in the form of referenda, right? Initiatives. And these proposals, because we are now the lawmakers, are it's a crazy system, I think. But because we are the lawmakers as people, we get a booklet in the mail that is usually about 300 to 400 pages long, that has a full text of all of the proposals that are being made. I have never met anyone who ever read even more than a few pages of that booklet. It's a tremendous waste of paper and time. What everyone does is they read the one-page summary. And then they read, there's an argument for, which is another page, and an argument against, which is another page, and then they make up their minds. You know, and I'm a lawyer, I got a PhD in linguistics as well, I'm interested in legal language, I can't get beyond one or two pages, to be honest, it's just so boring. So, and it's useless. So, I think that ultimately, Wikilaw is an interesting idea, but probably not going to get too terribly far beyond simply in the legislature. The question as to whether it will lead to having all this law online, to pressure from citizens who want to understand the law, to make it more comprehensible, whether they will ultimately win, or whether the lawyers, who are also a very powerful lobbying group, who are afraid of what that could do to their monopoly, basically, on legal services, how is that going to come out? Time will tell.
Actually storing and transmitting language affecting, you know, the current legal system, the writing of the law in ancient Greece, Athens, the printing revolution leading to a more literal mode of interpreting text and so on. And we heard that the impact of modern technology can, on statutory law, obviously, can actually bring some advantages to making laws more, you know, accessible to ordinary citizens, and at the same time also adding some sort of democratic value to such laws. So, thank you for your highly fascinating lecture. Now, at this point, I would like to ask the audience again to make questions, comments. Of any other points that the Professor Tiesma raised in his highly interesting and fascinating lecture. I think you should come here, because there's no walking on the microphone.
From California, born and raised, and grew up under the referendum system. And the one thing that and I grew up under the referendum system as well. And one of the things I was thinking as we were talking about this is that I'm not so sure that I believe that ordinary legislators ordinary people don't think they're ordinary. They say the legal language specifically because it can sort of obfuscate the facts. And even with summaries, there are often referendums that come up that are using. There was one like 5 years ago about preventing the government from collecting data on national origin and language and things like that, which, I mean, the summary sounds relatively innocuous, but the groups that were for it were attempting to,